Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 88 of my Sexy Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. So first of all, I'd like to welcome all you to part two of episode number 88 of my 6G Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or on Stitcher, or on iHeartRadio, or on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 6G music fan slash expert slash nerd, and each week of this podcast, I take one song from one artist from the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part of the show is talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it's excellent, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chord, smell, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, I dig deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, I talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, who are the musicians in the track, whether that be the session musicians or the band members themselves, the history behind the artists that recorded the song and the songwriters that wrote it, and the label the song is released on, where that label is located at, where the studio the song was recorded at, where that studio was located at, and the peak position the song made up originally on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, and the year and month the song was released. All that is in the second part of the show. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's song and artists such as Peter and Gordon and I Go to Pieces. But more importantly, let's talk about the British Invasion, because I noticed that it's definitely been a while since I've covered a British Invasion artist, and we've talked about it here and there, because we've done a couple by now, but we haven't really done a deep dive into it as to what was going on with the British Invasion and how much it affected American music and vice versa. Well, in this week's episode of the podcast, I'm going to go pretty in-depth as to what... Now, the main focus with this week's episode is that since we're talking about the British Invasion, we have to talk about the parallels of the music that was going on in America and what was going on in England, and how those things are somewhat related to each other, and how much the British Invasion, how much it affected had on American music, and how much American music had an effect on the British Invasion, and sort of the parallels between the similarities between the British music of the 60s and the American music of the 60s. Because trust me, even though we were on two completely different continents on opposite ends of the world, you know, there is definitely a correlation between what was going on in American music and what was going on with the British music scene in the early to mid-60s, and late 60s as well. And yeah, so let's talk about that, shall we? And one more thing I wanted to mention to you about this week's episode of the podcast is that we're going to talk about the history of the Beatles, because honestly, it's kind of hard to like do a whole episode on the British Invasion and not really talk about them specifically, but like I said before, I don't want this podcast to be entirely focused on them, even though this group is heavily involved in their career in some way or another. But really, this episode's going to be more just on the British Invasion in general, because what happened with the Beatles, also similar things happen with other groups as well. But before we talk about that, you know, let's talk about how much of an impact the British Invasion had on popular culture. But, you know, before we get into the start of the British Invasion, which was really February 9th of 1964, we have to talk about what was going on in American popular music before any of that happened. Okay, so before that specific date, the pop music on the Billboard Hot 100 charts was either cliche love songs or extremely mediocre novelty songs. I mean, but even though there was a lot going on in R&B, you know, that was kind of what the pop music spectrum was like in the early 60s. But the main thing to keep in mind about this specific time frame from 1960 to 63 is that pretty much 90% of what you heard on top 40 radio at this time were songs that were not written by the artists that recorded them. because when you turn on the radio, every single song you heard was written by songwriters that then weren't artists themselves and were produced by not by the artists themselves, and, you know, had studio musicians playing on them and vocal groups that didn't necessarily accompany themselves on their recordings. So essentially 90% of these artists were working with a whole team of songwriters and studio players and producers pretty much handling the music aspects of their songs for them. And this was true for most of the groups, including groups like the Shirelles and Bobby V and some of those other sort of early 60s groups, and with the exception of the Beach Boys and Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, because those groups were, for the most part, self-contained. And really the only self-contained bands that were happening, you know, before the British Invasion happened were the instrumental groups like the Ventures and the Shantays and the Safaris. And also, there were definitely much more focus on the solo artists like the teen idols and the girl singers like Leslie Gore and Connie Francis and Bobby Rydell and, Bobby V and, you know, Frankie Avalon versus the actual groups. But another noteworthy thing to mention around this time is that, you know, before the British invasion happened, there wasn't a whole lot of foreign non-US records being released and becoming hits in America around this time. Even though there were some, but they were mostly instrumentals. I mean, like, for example, Apache by Jorgen Ingerman, that was a foreign record and that was a big hit in America. And a couple other ones like Alley Cat by Ben Fabric and a song by Burt Kempfert, Wonderland by Night. I mean, those were all recorded in different countries, but essentially these were all instrumental songs. And although there were exceptions, you know, like Kaiu Sakamoto by Sukiyaki, you know, that was literally one of the biggest foreign records to in America at the time, going all the way number one in May, June 1963. But for the most part, there weren't too many foreign acts on the pop charts around this time, like in the early 60s. And you see, 90% of the music that was literally on the American charts, you know, on Billboard, were from American songwriters and producers and musicians. But that all changed once the British invasion happened in February 1964. But even before that, there were hints of there being a complete takeover of British music in the coming years, even though these songs never really reflected the genre that would become known as the British invasion. And these songs were in fact recorded in England, but were released in America. These songs included Stranger on the Shore by Mr. Acker Bilk, You Don't Have to Be Baby to Cry by the Caravels, and Midnight in Moscow by Kenny Ball and his Jazzmen. Now, here's the thing. So this was like in a completely different time, right? This is before the internet, before Spotify, before Apple Music, before people can just Google any song they want and listen to it. Some of you on here are probably wondering, how the heck did these British tracks get over to America at a time before we even had such easy access to music, before we can just look up any song we want on Spotify or Apple Music? Well, that's a great question. You see, the four big British record labels, which at the time were EMI, Decca, Pi, and Philips, all at the time had deals with independent labels in America to get their songs to the hands of the record-buying public. And so when a British song got released on one label in America, it wouldn't be on the same label as the one where it get released in England, and vice versa. So a lot of times you would have the same song being released on a different label in England than it was in America, and vice versa. But essentially, all the four big British record labels, they all, you know, had deals with a lot of these independent American labels, so that way, you know, their stuff can get heard in Britain and vice versa. And also, because of this, these independent dealings done with these independent labels in America, with coinciding with the four big British labels, EMI, Decca, Pi, and Philips, 90% of the British invasion bands, and this goes for the Beatles as well, certain songs would be released as singles in the US but not in the UK. And the UK were only available on a band's album and not as a single, and on the flip side. And some songs would get released as singles in the UK but not in America. And in America, the song would not be available on it, would only be available on an album. and some songs would get released as B-sides in America, but on A-sides in the UK. So essentially, I know that sounds kind of confusing, but the point is that before the internet, a lot of times the British kids didn't often get the same kind of released, music as the American kids did. A lot of times the American kids got, you know, a different song as an A-side, then the UK kids got a different song as the A-side. And then, see, a lot of times, you know, the American releases and the British releases will a lot of times be separate, and they wouldn't always be the same. And that is something that really doesn't happen anymore, because now it's all on the internet. But back then, before we even had such technology, this is just the way things were. And for example, you know, certain songs that would get released by the Beatles as singles, you wouldn't be able to find them on any Beatles album. And same thing, there are some songs that got released as album tracks, you know, on Beatles albums, you'd never be able to find them as a single. And, you know, that's just the way things were back then, you know. And this was all because of independent business dealings with the English record labels and the American ones. But this is also how the British bands got access to hit singles by American artists and vice versa. You know, this is how the American kids got to hear British songs, and this is how the British kids got to hear American music, all because, you know, these British labels had independent dealings with these American labels. But really, in the early 60s, British music hadn't quite taken off in America yet. And the biggest success story of them all when it came to the British invasion, aka the Beatles, it was really all about timing. But they too had to find a good American record company to distribute their songs. You know, otherwise their chances of making it in America were slim to none. And in the beginning, EMI, the label they were on, you know, their EMI's American counterpart, Capitol, didn't want to distribute the band in America because at the time they really couldn't get behind the band's potential of making it in America. So because of this, other smaller labels picked up on the band like VJ and Swan Records, but it wasn't until a last-minute move by Capitol is when they decided to buy their masters and distribute them in America is when they blew up. But one very important thing I wanted to point out to you about the British invasion is that, you know, it was pretty much already happening, you know, in England in the early 60s, because every single British invasion band that would have huge success in America after February 9th, 1964 were, I mean, they were already having huge top 10 and 20 hits in England, but not in America in the early 60s. So before the Beatles landed onto American soil, you know, all the big British invasion bands that would have hits, you know, in America after that happened, they were already doing it in England. I mean, they were already huge. But once the Beatles came to America, that's when the floodgates opened, and that's when they started to have hits, you know, after that very specific date. And then a lot of those songs that were already hits in England got re-released in America, and they became hits again once they got re-released in America. And all this happened after they made their debut on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 9th, 1964. And then after that, essentially all hell broke loose. And what I mean by that is that literally within weeks after that happened, five British bands acts showed up on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. You know, all of a sudden, we went from having almost no British music and pretty much none at all to having, you know, five bands in five groups in the UK on the charts. And the British invasion had arrived. When the Beatles began their monopoly on the charts, a bunch of other groups followed shortly after them. More specifically, the Searchers, Dave Clark 5, and Dusty Springfield, and the String of Blue Jeans as well. But like I said before, 90% of the British groups that were finally getting their big break in America after February 9th, 1964, were already raking up top 10 20 hits in England a year before, in 1963, before people even really knew about them in America. And again, it was really all about timing, because in February of 1964, America was just 4 months past the JFK assassination, and the country was desperately needing something positive, uplifting during the very dark times of when our president that many people looked up to was all of a sudden taken from us, thus ending this period of innocence in America and this sort of uncertainty and this sort of point where it's like, we don't know what's going to happen. Hopefully, you know, something good happens so that way something can rescue us from this pain that we're kind of still in from that very tragic event. And basically what happened was that their answer to that was when the Beatles came on to Ed Sullivan's show in 1964, and then were they were basically the light shining in the darkness for a lot of young people at that time. Okay, so when the Beatles are taking over the Billboard charts in the winter spring months in 1964, and this is very much a literal takeover because they were the first artists to have 5 songs on the top 5 and all recorded by them and nobody else. There was definitely more of an emphasis on the music written and recorded by them and nobody else, but they certainly did not want to record every song that they wrote. So they gave certain songs they didn't want to record away to groups like Billy J. Graham and Dakotas, who were managed by their manager Brian Epstein. But this leads me to talk about the history behind Peter and Gordon, because they were at the time not managed by Brian Epstein, but they were one of the few groups at the time who got a hold of some Beatles songs that they did not want to record. And I know you're wondering exactly, how the heck were they able to do that? Well, that's a great question. I'm going to go into that right now with this part 2 of this 2-part episode of this podcast. Okay, so when the Beatles are blowing up in America in early 1964, Paul McCartney was going out with a girl named Jane Asher, who at the time was a sister of a guy named Peter Asher. Peter had just started a duet with a buddy of his named Gordon Waller. And on top of that, Paul was living with Peter at Peter's home when all of Beatlemania hysteria was going on in America. So because of that, Peter got to hear some soon-to-be huge hits by them that they haven't recorded yet, like I Want to Hold Your Hand. But when Paul wrote a song that he didn't think was good enough for the Beatles to record, he gave it to Peter and Gordon, and they recorded it in January of 1964 at Abbey Road Studios in London. Keep in mind, Peter and Gordon were on the same label as the Beatles. Even when the Beatles were on Parlophone and Peter and Gordon were on Columbia, all those labels were under the same EMI umbrella. And basically, they're on the same EMI umbrella labels. And on the session included Vic Flick on guitar, Harold Smart on organ, Alan Weidel and or Rod Prentice on bass, and probably Andy White on drums. And the song was released at the end of February of that year. And in America, the song went to number 1 in June 1964, making it the first ever Lennon and McCartney song unrecorded by their band, basically, that they didn't want to record. And by doing that, basically, it was the first song that they didn't record that someone else recorded and had a huge hit with it. And so, since they had a huge hit with that song, Peter and Gordon later went on to record 3 more songs written by Lennon and McCartney, and they all became hits, and those songs were I Don't Want to See You Again, Nobody I Know, and Woman. But the song I'm doing this week is a song that wasn't written by Lennon and McCartney, actually it wasn't a Beatles song, and it brings up a very important part about how tuned in British bands were to American music, because like I said before, these British bands heard American tunes when their labels made deals with the British labels to get these songs released in America on different labels than they were. And, you know, they basically got to hear a lot of these American songs because these American labels made deals with the, you know, British labels. So that way, you know, their stuff could get released in the UK, which is on a different label. But also because of the group's publishers and the labels they are affiliated with them in the UK, the British bands were able to get a hold of a lot of songs that weren't even professionally recorded yet by anybody. And that was the case with this particular song. Okay, so now we're going to finally talk about the history behind this week's song, because this was not a Beatles song. They did not write this song, I Go to Pieces. It was actually written by an American songwriter you probably never heard of before, and this might be the first time you ever really be hearing about them ever, and his name was Del Shannon. Del was a singer-songwriter who was originally from Battle Creek, Michigan, though he made 90% of his hits in New York City, and he was known to audiences for his very dark and depressing love songs that possibly gave people insight on his own life as well. And interestingly enough, one thing I want to point out about Del Shannon is that he, along with Sam Cooke and Neil Sedaka and a few others, he wrote most of his own songs. And this was something that was kind of unusual at the time because people of his stature were having other people write songs for them. But he, for the most part, wrote most of his own songs. And most of his hits were songs that he wrote, either with Max Crook or a couple other people. But Oftentimes, his songs were about warning guys about girls, about a girl that was no good, or him and his girl running away from people that didn't want to be associated with. And, you know, just depressing songs about losing a loved one and not knowing how or why she disappeared, and, you know, and songs of that nature. And on a side note, one of his earlier records utilized an instrument that actually became a precursor to what would be now called as synthesizers. The instrument on the record was a really early interpretation of what was what we now call synthesizers, and that instrument was called the Munistron. So there definitely was a flavor in modern recording technology in the songs before we even had such thing, you know, because his biggest hit song, Runaway, which came out in 1961, had that instrument front and center. And, you know, it was the first time we ever really got exposure to something like that. And he also had his ears pretty low to the ground for when it came to music overseas as well, as he was the first artist to cover a Beatles tune before February 1964. And he actually had a chart hit with it. And that song was called For Me to You. Although it didn't make the top 40, it actually peaked at number 77. And, you know, this was 1963. So this is way before people even knew about them in America. And even though it wasn't a top 40 hit, it probably was an original hit in certain parts of the country. But enough about the Beatles. Let's talk about Del Shannon, because when the British invasion was happening in 1964, Del was struggling to have hits on. But this particular song would provide Del with a career comeback for him when his last couple of singles, which were, by the way, all covers of other people's tunes, Handyman, Do You Wanna Dance, they all kind of didn't really do so well. And, I mean, they were original hits, but they weren't huge top 40 hits. And he didn't want to record the song himself at first. Again, I go to pieces of the song that he wanted somebody else to record, because he originally produced a version for an artist he discovered named Lloyd Brown. But when he did that, no label was interested in distributing the single. And I've actually heard the original version of the song. It's no different than Peter and Gordon's version. It's pretty much the same, but essentially, I think the reason why no label wanted to distribute it was because the recording quality, the original version, was too crude and not high quality enough for them to want to take, you know, distribute it. And so after that happened, he took a crack at recording the song at a few different studios, but even he himself couldn't lay down a vocal take that he was satisfied with. So for a couple months, he sat on the song, not doing anything with it, until he did a tour in Australia that all of a sudden changed the fate of the song entirely. Okay, so even though Del wasn't having any major hits as an artist at this time, he had a single coming out on a new record label he had just signed with, Amy Records, that would become his next top 40 hit. But in the meantime, he was still trying to find a home for the song that he wrote, that he couldn't really do that. You know, because he tried to record the song himself, and he produced a version with Lloyd Brown, an artist he discovered, but he couldn't, you know, the song wasn't going anywhere. It was just collecting dust and not really doing anything. And so in 1964, when he wrote the song, he decided to do a tour in Australia. And this is when the fate of the song all of a sudden changed. And when he was doing this tour in Australia, he was sharing the bill with two different artists. One group, and they were both British. One group was called The Searchers, and they were huge at the time, with lots and lots of hits. And the other artist on the bill was Peter and Gordon. And basically, when they were doing the show, Del performed the song to The Searchers, because he originally wanted The Searchers to record the song, in their dressing room, hoping they would record it. And even though they weren't interested in recording the song, Peter and Gordon were in the same dressing room when they were basically hearing the song that Del was pitching to The Searchers, but the Searchers weren't interested in recording it. They were in the same room here, and they overheard that song. And basically, they approached Del after he pitched the song to The Searchers, and The Searchers didn't want to record it, and they said, "Hey, man, we love this song. We want to record it, can we?" And they asked Del, you know, they basically asked him for his permission, and Del said sure. And then after the tour is over, Peter and Gordon went back to England at Abbey Road Studios, with John Berger's producing and Jeff Love arranging and conducting. And Peter and Gordon also played acoustic guitar on the record with their friend slash guitar tech, Eddie King, playing the song, distinctive 12-string guitar in the song. And basically, the thing to keep in mind about this is that they got the song when Del performed it for the Searchers, but when they went in the studio to record it, they didn't change a thing about it when they went in the studio to record the song, because this had been recorded yet professionally. They copied pretty much everything from the original demo version of the song. I mean, everything, the demo version was pretty much exactly the same as their version. I mean, the only difference is that it was, their version was sped up slightly, but they pretty much retained everything from the original demo version of the song. But that's just something to keep in mind. But, you know, that's kind of where that parallel between, like, the American and British music happened back then. And so when they recorded I Go to Pieces, and they released the song as a single in November of 1964, and I believe it was the follow-up to I Don't Want to See You Again. And in February 1965, the song was in the top 10 on Billboard Hot 100 charts, and this was the first hit song for Peter and Gordon that was not written by the Beatles. And it was also a huge comeback hit for Del Shannon, as he also had another hit song under his own artist name that he also wrote that was basically released and on the charts at the exact same time as I Go to Pieces. And that song was Keep Searching with Follow the Sun, and that was released on AMI Records. And Peter and Gordon, after that, had a string of UK hits with their own versions of some 50s American hits. Now, keep in mind, how they even got a hold of these songs is that these tunes were released in UK on different labels than they were released in America, and that's how Peter and Gordon picked up on both of those songs. And they also had one huge hit penned by Lennon McCartney, and that was a song that Paul wrote actually under a different name that he decided to go under pseudonym so that way people wouldn't know that was him that wrote that song, and that song was Woman. And while he managed to have one more huge UK hit with Lady Godiva and a few more after that in America, once the late 60s kind of came about and the British invasion was evolving from, you know, the Brit pop rock thing that was going on into something really more psychedelic and experimental, Peter decided that he got tired of being an artist who didn't produce, and he really got into being a producer after he produced Paul Jones' first solo album after he left Manfred Mann that never really went anywhere. And so it was after he produced that album that he decided that he didn't want to be an artist anymore. He wanted to be someone more behind the scenes. So after the career of him and his partner Gordon Waller started to dwindle, and this was like in the late 60s, he became the head of A&R at the Beatles record label Apple Records. And in the next decade, he would later go on to discover and produce for James Taylor, specifically, and Linda Ronstadt. And essentially what happened was that James Taylor was originally on Apple Records, but then they moved him over to Warner Brothers, and then that's when he was also producing Linda Ronstadt. But him and Gordon would reunite occasionally over the years until he died about 11 years ago. And by the way, I'm talking about Gordon Waller, not Peter Asher. But currently what's happening right now with Peter is that he's getting a lot of publicity because he is currently a DJ for the Beatles channel on Sirius XM because he was really good friends with them and he had a lot of really insight in their career. And he's also a published author on a book on the Beatles called The Beatles from A to Z, and it's out right now. And he's doing a lot right now, and he's very active, you know, in the music industry. And, you know, he does shows at the Grammy Museum, and he's doing a lot of stuff, you know. So, and he's a very accomplished guy. And one day I'll get to meet him, and hopefully I'll get to pick his brain about his career and some of this other stuff that happened back then. So that concludes part two of episode number 88 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and by the way, one more thing. After Peter and Gordon had their huge hit with their version of A Go to Pieces, Del Shannon actually recorded the song and did a version of the song totally based off of their arrangement of it. So, you know, that goes to show you, you know, that he had a total admiration for their version of the song. He decided to take a crack at it himself and was able to record his own version of it just from, you know, basing it off of their arrangement of it, you know, that was really cool. But anyway, so I'm Sam Williams, and if you found out some really cool and interesting facts about Peter and Gordon and Del Shannon from listening to this episode of this podcast, you never really knew anything about them, really, you can email me at samltwilly@icloud.com. By the way, Del Shannon, just a few more things about him. He discovered Bob Seger and produced some demos for him, in the mid-60s before he ever became famous. And he also became a producer for Brian Hyland and an arranger for Smith, which was a band. And he did a lot of other things as well, but those are the things that he's mainly well known for. And Tom Petty was also a huge fan of him. And I think right around before he died, you know, they were planning. Tom Petty was planning on producing an album for Del, and I think he did actually. But this was like in the late 80s. But anyway, so that's basically your gist about Del Shannon. And if you never really knew anything about them and you learned a lot of stuff about him from listening this episode of this podcast, you can email me at samltwilly@icloud.com. And you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies, and check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. And also, a couple other things you can check out that are always in the description of this episode of this podcast include last week's song, the YouTube link to that, and also it's in the description of this episode of this podcast is the links to my Spotify and YouTube playlists for the show. There you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some ones that I've mentioned in interview episodes. Hopefully you will check those out. And hopefully that should give you a good idea as to which kind of, songs to talk about on my podcast. And hopefully that will give you an idea as to which kind of music I should talk about next on my show that I haven't talked about yet. And if that does, you can email me at samltwilly@icloud.com. And you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies and let me know what kind of songs you think I should do next on my podcast that I haven't done yet. Well, you can kind of get a good idea for that by listening to my the Spotify and YouTube playlist for the show. And also, another cool thing you can check out in the description of this episode of this podcast is the official Redbubble merch store for the show. There you'll be able to find this really cool logo that I didn't design, but I came up with the design. It's basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode of this podcast and keep on trucking tie-dye font with the name of my podcast in the bottom. There's a couple really cool merchandise items on there, actually a bunch, and you can go on there and you can basically, check it out, and you can even purchase something as well. You don't have to, but I would love it if you could do that. But if you don't want to, or you just want to take a look at it and let me know what you think of the logo and the prices of each item in the store, I would really appreciate that as well. You can go do that. The link to that is in the description of this episode of this podcast. And yeah, so next week's episode is going to be episode 90, so we're really close to episode 100. And like I told you guys, I'm going to a very special event at the end of this month, the Love and Spoonful reunion show. You know, and if you don't know who they are, they're a band I've covered on this podcast before. Well, I'm going to probably meet a couple of the original members of the band after it's over, after the show is over. So I'm very excited to go to that. And I'll let you guys know, if I'm able to secure the next interview for my podcast after meeting one of them, in person. I think that would be really cool. But for right now, I'll keep you guys posted when the next interview episode will happen and who's it gonna be, because I'm saving that for episode 100. It might be one of the members of Spoonful. It might be Tom Kenny. We'll see. But I'll definitely keep you guys posted on that. But yeah, so anyway, so I'm Sam Williams, and thank you for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things groovy.